radiating a kilowatt of power from a real good location. Getting 30 miles of range is very difficult because you study what's going on with transmitting broadband television versus audio. You're almost at a million to one disadvantage in power, bandwidth of the receiver, bandwidth of the transmission, and so on. So slow scan TV. Once you slow down the method by which you're transmitting the video information, you come out with these huge advantages. So I wonder if that's some of what you were looking for, Jim. KD2BHY, K2RIW on TechNet. Please wait for the four beeps.
So much. That was a really good explanation of my question, and I'm really glad I asked because I was pretty curious when I was decoding it, and it was really fascinating. I would suggest it to anyone out there who's interested in it to try and decode SSTV from the ISS. They usually post the when they're going to do it on the ARRL website. Back to you. K2RAW, KD2BHY.
Yeah, commercial, I'm Jasmine 12, my voice is not safe.
Another good point there, Eric, and that is the very elaborate filter that's required to take double sideband video amplitude modulation and make it vestigial sideband, which was the broadcast standard. Some very fancy filtering is required. Now, Jim, you've successfully done slow scan TV reception from the International Space Station. To some guys, there's a significant learning curve. Where did you start off? Where did the smarts come from? How did you do it? I mean, one way to do it is to write a check and make the problem go away. Just buy the right test equipment, connect it to an antenna, and aim it at the ISS. Or a more conventional amateur might decide, I want to build all this equipment. So where did you start off finding out about this? How did you know that it existed? Where did you go for information? How much of a learning curve was there for you? Was it immediately successful? Did you have to get some of the bugs out of it? Give us a little bit of the history from your point of view, Jim. KD2BHY, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Actually, much easier than I thought it would be. I had first heard about it reading through one of the study manuals for the test. I had first heard that there was amateur radio aboard the ISS, and later I'd looked it up after I was trying to get into some satellite stuff, and I had read that not only is there voice, but there's APRS and also SSTV. So what I did was, because I already had some satellite equipment, which actually isn't very expensive. All you really need is a 2-meter radio for receiving SSTV from the ISS specifically. All you really need is a 2-meter radio, a directional antenna, and a computer. Now, in order to receive the signals, all you need is the antenna and the radio, but if you want to actually decode them, the computer is what you need. So I began by first just trying to listen to the APRS signals, which are always going, not at only scheduled times. And I had gotten good reception. So next that I had heard on the ARRL website, they said they were transmitting over the weekend, so I decided to give it a shot. And yeah, it worked pretty well. What I did, because I didn't have an interface from the computer to the radio, so what I did was I recorded the audio, and then I played it back for the computer through the microphone, and yeah, it worked pretty well. It's not really that expensive to get into. It's not really that hard to do. All you really need to do is know when the ISS is passing overhead and know when the SSTV is transmitting. And a good way to do that is to go on to issfanclub.com, and it gives you when things are transmitting, what's transmitting, a whole bunch of information. And if you'd like any more information, that's a good website to go to. Back to you, Jim.
Very well done, Jim. You've now given us a little bit of your history, how you got into it. Now, it sounds to me, from the sound of what I'm hearing, you've been successful. You've decoded some of those pictures from the ISS. Tell us what you saw. What do those pictures look like, Jim? KD2BHY, K2RW, and worry a little bit about not going beyond 1.5 minutes.
Actually, this year they're doing a Yuri Gagarin memorial thing. So all the pictures are pictures of Yuri Gagarin, who was the first man in space, and a lot of pictures of the first spacecraft and of Yuri himself. Back to you.
times they've got pictures of the astronauts themselves while they're doing something on the International Space Station. And occasionally they do things like aim the camera at the ground, out the window, and show you what you see. Although there, it's a higher resolution picture and might be a little bit more difficult to send by slow scan television. Slow scan television is not going to be high definition television as far as the quality of the picture is concerned. Okay, correct me on that one. You're telling me that occasionally slow scan television, by modern digital standards, can be a high definition television-like picture. 1,000 lines almost, Eric, is that what you're saying? K2EJ, give us a tiny bit more audio. K2RIW, you got it, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. There are different formats that are sent, and some of them are actually quite high resolution. They take a while to generate a picture, but the old standards, they're relatively low resolution. But that days beyond yonder. Use of the various different standards, they start from like things 100 pixels by 100 pixels and go all the way up to 1,000 pixels. So you get some pretty good results.
And this really is a ham on board the ISS in many cases, talking, broadcasting, so to speak, to hams on the ground. And I've often said there's 26 or 27 different kinds of ham radio. I'm not sure that ISS slow scan TV has been included in that list. There may be 28 kinds of ham radio. There's lots of kinds. And so, ain't heard the end of the story yet. Fantastic. Boy, there's no end to this. It turns out that the American public, for instance, just can't get enough wireless equipment. We want wireless everything. In the ideal world, we'd like to have a wireless keyboard, a wireless mouse, a wireless display device, a wireless computer. That's what we put in our pocket these days. We'd like to be continuously connected to the internet and so on. So everybody forgets about the fact that all of this jazz is radio. The average public using a cell phone. Hey, I'm using a telephone. They don't even know sometimes that it's a radio. Good stuff. Keep it up, Jim, and come back periodically and tell us how exciting some of those pictures you're downloading are. And one last question for you, Jim. A person starting off from scratch, deciding to get the slow scan television pictures from the ISS, if he's already got a desktop computer and he's got a ham radio that can listen to the 2-meter band, for instance, he's got a reasonable antenna, how big an investment is it to get a slow scan TV picture? Is it just downloading a free piece of software and properly connecting the audio out of your transmitter into the computer program of your computer? Roughly how many bucks does it take, or how many hours does it take to go from nothing to getting the pictures you're getting, Jim? KD2BHY, K2RIW, the TechNet.
To be honest, and I'm going to say that it really doesn't cost anything to do it if you have that set up. All you need is some free software, which you can just search up on Google. But I will say that it might take a few passes of the ISS to get your bearings, to understand how to listen to it, how to get everything recorded right. Sometimes you feel like you need three hands because there's a lot of stuff going on that you have to manage. But I'd say maybe after a few passes, I think you're pretty good. You're in business. You can get some good pictures going. K2RAW, KD2BH1.
The comment.
Yeah, I'll get to the comment in a minute. Part of what Jim told us earlier is that you get a lot of information going to the website, ISSFanClub.com. Will that give me 80% of what I want to know, Jim? And is there another website you would recommend that we go to? KD2BHY, K2RIW.
Definitely, ISSFanClub.com really helps you out. It really gives you a lot of information. It tells you what's happening, when. And it really helped me out a lot. Also, I would suggest the AMSAT website for tracking satellites and stuff like that. Also, to track the ISS, I use a free app on my phone called Go ISS Watch. It's free, and I always use it, and it works very well. Back to you.
Very well done, Jim. We're going to give you a star with your call letters and name on the big book. Who you, go ahead.
Yeah, it's just me. I just wanted to comment that tuning in at flow scan on the ISS is a lot easier than it is on the frequency equation. Makes sense under that map. You've got no control over the frequency of the tones other than the Doppler shift that occurs. But, actually, that's an effect of the output of the audio. It's FM. What happens is it goes off frequency. The other thing is, I believe the frequencies that they use are like 145.8 to flow scan. They also have done fast scan. I've done all 96 in the past. The packet frequencies are 145.825. K2RWK2K.
Hi, thank you, Eric. Okay, next person was Robert, KD2CGL. Sorry we kept you waiting so long, Robert. And what would you like to discuss tonight? KQRIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
A few simple questions here. Is Glen Oaks currently running the 23-centimeter repeater? And I just got an Alinco G29 nice radio. And seems like there's not too much of the 33 centimeters out there. The closest one that I know of that I can trip the repeater is at Manhattan and Rockefeller Center. How much of a beam would I need to try and help me out on 33 centimeters? That's basically it.
So let's start off with Eric, who is the technical maven of the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club. What's the current status of the so-called 1296, and probably 1284, the 23-centimeter region repeater in Manhattan? I think it's in Manhattan. What's the status of it? Watts output? What's your range you get with what kind of an antenna? Tell us whatever you can on that one first, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RAW. K2RAW,
K2EJ. The last I checked was last week, it wasn't fine. A bunch of people were asking about it. It's pretty much very quiet. It doesn't have a heck of a lot of power. The thing is 15 watts, 18 watts, something like that. And then passes through the duplexes, so you lose some. Then passes through what? Passes through inch and an eighth. And it gets up to the roof, so you lose a little bit of it. And winds up in the antenna. As far as the repeater in Manhattan goes, I have no awareness of it.
Now, I've made a lot of use, thank you, Eric, I've made a lot of use of the 432 band, and by the time you get up to 1296, and as well as 432, what you use for an antenna and how high the antenna is makes quite a bit of difference. This is the best of all worlds. You're going to have an array of Yagis, multiple Yagis, as long as you can get and mount as high as you can get to clear the local trees and so on. As your antenna on 432 and 1296 moves down in altitude, you're transmitting from trees, particularly when the trees have got leaves on them in the summertime, and right after a rain, when the trees have got water coating those leaves. Water on leaves is a rather anechoic material. It's a fancy way of saying the radio signal hits the leaves, gets absorbed, turned into heat, and it's gone. So your range comes down real fast. 1296 Yagis, if you buy them commercially, they're a little bit pricey. A real good company, for instance, is the one in Lebanon, Maine, by K1WHS. All of a sudden, I can't think of the name of the company. It'll come to me in a minute. Also, you could homebrew the antenna out of a coat hanger wire, for instance. And if you go to that beautiful website of Kent Britton, let me drop it. Kent's website is on WA5VJB, Whiskey Alpha 5, VictorJulietBravo.com. Whiskey Alpha 5, VictorJulietBravo.com. Dr. Kent Britton has a beautiful website where he sells printed circuit Yagis, printed circuit antennas, log periodics, and whatever. He's probably got some 1296 ones in there. Also, if you study his website a little bit, there's a second or third page in which he shows you how to build cheap Yagis out of coat hanger wires, literally, and sticks of wood. So for no real bucks, you can build a rather high-gain antenna, and multiple ones of them. So you can either buy or build, and all of a sudden, Electronics is the name of his company. So that's one possible approach. So as you use a lower loss feed line, as you raise the antenna to a higher altitude, as you use an antenna that's more like a flashlight where it aims the signal in one direction, and that's that gives you benefit both on transmitting and receiving. And as you do all these things, low noise front end, low loss feed line, high antenna, high gain antenna, as you do all these things, your range will double every time you make those changes, if you know what I mean. And so the total amount of repeater, the total amount of amateur occupation on 1296, let me drop, is relatively small compared to 432 or 450. Is relative, 450 is a little bit smaller than 2 meters. And so as you go up there to the higher frequencies, there's less people to talk to. In general, they're higher quality people. Among the microwave enthusiasts that I like to talk to on 2 gigs and above, particularly the group on 10 gigahertz, these are really smart people. Anytime you meet one of them, you pick their brain and find out how do they solve the problem of good antenna, good feed line, good transmitter, good receiver, and good range. And so I haven't been on 10 gigs for a good long period of time. I want to get back onto it because way back between 1990 and 2000, I talked to guys in 10 separate states on 10 gigahertz from my home location with nothing but a 2-foot dish on the top of 100 feet of tower. Talked to guys in 10 states, single sideband. I never radiated more than 2/10 of a watt, all solid state. So I was QRP, QRP, if you know what I mean. I talked to guys in 10 states, best range of 388 miles. So if you're willing to make the investment, there's a lot of fun up there. But you can't get up there at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Tuesday and call CQ and get an answer, if you know what I mean. It's not like 20 meters. So you pay your money, you take your choice. So maybe that's some of the information you're looking for, Robert. KD2CGL, the microwave voice of Oceanside, New York. K2RIW, you got it, Robert.
Actually, the HT I just got is the discontinued Alinco that has 900 megs, not 1200, although they do have one of those too. In any case, the repeater to the east is 20 miles, that's West Islip, that is Bark. Another 900 repeater to the west is Rockefeller Center, also 20 miles. And I do hear the repeater up north, 35 miles in Rockland County, Orangeburg. I'm just curious, how much of a beam would I need? For example, M squared makes a lovely 900 meg beam that has 21 decibels of forward gain. $100, not bad. What kind of a beam would I need? That's my question.
And by the way, I'm pretty dumb. You did say 33 centimeters. I thought I heard 23 centimeters. I should have realized you're talking about not 900, not 1296. But most of those words are still the same. And by the way, that company that also makes antennas at that frequency region is Directive Systems in West Lebanon, Maine, run by Dave O'Lean, K1WHS. So Directive Systems, they make antennas for that frequency region. M Squared does. The WA5BJB.com website. Mr. Kent Britton of Kent Electronics, he will show you how to build coat hanger wire antennas for all of these frequencies for very inexpensive prices. So do you write the check and buy a real good antenna, or do you build it because you want to save the money? Do you like the experimenting? Now, how much gain do you need is sort of what you've asked, and there's no good answer for that one, as I see it, Dave. It's almost like saying, will I be happier if I marry a blonde, a brunette, or a redhead? And should I marry a tall lady or a short lady? And so on. There's no exact answer to either one of these. As you use more antenna, more altitude, lower loss feed line, lower loss, low noise preamplifier, you'll get more and more range. And how much range do you want? And how many repeaters are out there, and how far are they away? And how much reliability do you want to them? Let me drop a key. I'm a guy who really appreciates high-gain antennas. I'm a guy who really appreciates high-altitude antennas. As such, I've got 100 feet of tower. At times, I've used 16 Yagis in one antenna system on 432 megacycles. 16 Yagis all at once. If you go to Mike Number 2's website, which is LimonTechNet.com, LimonTechNet.com, and the first picture you'll see there is my red QSO card, and there's ways you can expand that picture. You'll see me standing in the middle of an array of 16 Yagis on 432. That antenna was 16 feet wide, 15 feet high, 13 feet deep. That was 3,500 cubic feet of antenna, those 16 Yagis. And so with that, on 432, I talked to guys in, I forget how many states now, 450 separate guys, distances out to 480 miles. I would talk to K4CAW in Greensboro, North Carolina, 480 miles airline on sideband every Tuesday night with that antenna from 7:30 to 8 o'clock every Tuesday night. We did that for 4.5 years, summer, winter, spring, and fall. I mean, my radio horizon from the top of my tower is 40 miles out. 480 miles is 12 times the distance to my radio horizon. And I'm talking to him on sideband with 90% of copy, summer, winter, spring, and fall, half hour every single week, because we just couldn't believe the signal that far would go. Let me drop the phone. One of the things that you've heard me say so often is that once you transmit a radio signal, it goes to every cubic centimeter of this universe. Everything left to discuss is it above threshold of the equipment you're using? The signal never stops. Whether it's behind the hill, whether it's over the Earth curvature, whether it's behind the building, all of those obstacles will make the signal weaker. It never dies. The signal is always there. I worked on arguably the world's best anechoic chamber, 100 decibels, tempest-proof chamber at Edwards Air Force Base, the Benningfield anechoic facility. And this is an extremely well-designed room where it made sure that all signals are 100 dB weaker inside that room, so you can do some very sophisticated testing of high-power airplane transmitters without revealing the signal to the outside world. And so in that room, very carefully constructed, you take an AM transistor radio and you listen to the local broadcast station. The signal was weak as all hell inside that building. It's 100 dB weaker, but you can still hear it. It never goes to zero. So no matter what antenna you use, no matter how high it is, no matter how low a noise figure preamp, no matter how powerful your transmitter, you make changes to any of those things, you'll get more range. And how much range is enough? It's a function of how much investment you're willing to make, as I see it, Robert, how much investment you're willing to make, and how much of this do you enjoy? Let me drop. But I was talking every Tuesday night over 480 miles, and the guys on each end were accusing us of doing a hoax. We were doing this starting way back in 1980, I think it was. Roughly 1980s when we started doing it. We did it for 4.5 years. The guys on each end who had lower capability antennas, they assumed because they weren't hearing the signal on the other side that it was a pure hoax. They assumed that we were making a telephone call and making believe it's a real QSO. That's what they believed for 4.5 years in 1980. Can you imagine what a phone bill I would have run up if that was a hoax? And so eventually it was some guys midway between in the Washington, D.C. area on a high altitude, and they aimed their antenna first north when I'm transmitting and then south when he's transmitting, and these guys suddenly started saying, hey, these guys are really doing it. This is not a hoax. And it went on for 4.5 years. So I got great pleasure out of being accused of doing non-damn radio, if you know what I mean, because I was getting so much range that no one else was getting. And so maybe you'll get pleasure out of that. It's your choice, Robert. KD2, CGL, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, just two quick, simple questions, and that's it. Is the 1296 currently working in Glen Oaks? And is there ever a possibility that Glen Oaks will get 900 megs? That's it.
Yeah, Eric already told us that the Glen Oaks repeater is in operation. He heard that a few days ago. And whether or not they're going to get 900 megs, I mean, Eric has made multiple uses of 900 megs for other operations Let's find out if Erica's got that on the game plan. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Erica.
K2RIW, K2EJ.
No, I had 900 running between Selden and Glen Oak. I'll tell you, with all the stretch spectrum 900 megahertz telephones in Glen Oak, it's a pretty large place to put a 900 megahertz repeater. Actually, the gear that I took out would make two 900 megahertz repeaters. That's something to consider, but it wouldn't be at Glen Oak, that's for sure. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Yeah, when the antenna system is on top of a building that shares commercial services with the 900 meg spread spectrum techniques that are being used.
Not the commercial stuff as bad as it is the thousands of apartments with wireless phones.
Okay, so what I sense from what you're saying, Eric, is that if the person is living in a dense urban environment where there's a whole lot of wireless phones on 900 megs, then 900 megs is not going to please you. Because Dave is living in, Robert is living in Oceanside, which is nowhere near as urban. The number of his local townspeople on 900 meg cordless phones is going to be a much smaller number. So he's going to have much better sensitivity. So 900 megs is not going to be as bad for him as I see it. And so it depends on where you are. Because it's a shared assignment between ham radio and license-free equipment at 900 megs, in certain areas you're going to have some grief. And there are some fancy noise blanker-like circuits that can give you some aid along these lines. I remember, let me drop it.
No, not to say it didn't work, just all the spikes from the stretch spectrum is what really killed you. And, you know, the commercial stuff is there, but the saturation at Glen Oaks is ridiculous.
Yeah, good information, Eric. Now, what I'm getting at is that when I was on the 432 band during the early days of 1980-ish, when the Montauk Point radar, which is also on the 432 band, was operating with a gigawatt of effective radiated power coming out of that thing, a really potent radar at Montauk Point, it would bomb the living daylights out of the band where you couldn't hear a thing. And I made measurements of that signal being 100 decibels above my noise in the back lobes of the antenna. And I turned on a real good noise blanker made on the Drake R4C receiver. They had a super duper noise blanker. When I turned on that noise blanker, all those radar pulses absolutely went away. I could aim the front of my antenna at Montauk Point radar, where now I'm getting a signal that's just out of sight. I mean, it would almost arc over the end of the cable. I turned on that noise blanker, and a weak guy on 432 in the back lobes of my antenna in New Jersey would be easy copy. So when you've got impulse-like noise and this frequency hopping technique comes close to that, there are kinds of noise blankers that'll give you aid, if you know what I mean. So there's ways around this, and if you think 900 megs is a frontier...
Talking sideband.
Agreed. I'll admit that most of our radios do not contain a good noise blanker when it comes to FM reception, and they need it. I can remember listening to FM repeaters from my automobile when I used to drive up to Utica to the Romeo Development Center every weekend, and the lack of a good blanker on FM gave me a lot of grief because of the ignition noise I was getting out of my automobile. So there are ways around this. I mean, everybody who builds an FM receiver assumes that it doesn't need a noise blanker. Not true. You get some huge benefit out of a noise blanker in that application, in my opinion. So there's more to the story than first meets the eye. Got any further questions on all of the above, Robert? Go right ahead. KD2, CGL, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Anything that comes to mind is where possibly, Eric, would there be a 900 meg repeater? I know Glen Oaks is definitely not a good contender, so any other possible locations that might come to mind?
If you got the latest copy of the ARRL repeater guys, it's going to give you a lot of hints. Let's see what Eric's got to say. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ.
Okay, JJ. Yeah, the field guide has a whole bunch of them listed. There's a whole thing in them in New Jersey. Actually, I wound up picking a frequency that somebody else was on at first, which was actually a coordinated frequency. But, yeah, there's a bunch of them out there. There are sites that are considered, that we would consider putting 900 on and move nicely. Don't forget that 900 is a shared band. It's not an exclusive amateur band. Actually, we're like the fifth user of the band. And there's also ISM, and Dick, your ID readers are in the same neighborhood, so, you know. And then there's PhiloLine companies that use it. Because everything these days is Fed Spectrum, it's everywhere.
Yeah, I completely forgot about that. For 10 solid years, I worked as a consultant for a company that was designing and manufacturing RFID interrogators, RFID readers, radio frequency identification tags. And that transmits between 902 and 928 megahertz, inclusive. It's a pseudo-random frequency hopping mode of operation, 1 watt of power. There's not a great number of those readers out there yet. Someday there may be. So that's cordless phones, RFID readers, lots of stuff is on.
And ham repeaters at 921.
The 921 ham repeater is located where that you're mentioning, Eric? Go ahead.
As I said, they're all over the place. On the island, I think there's one out east. There's nothing in the middle here. There's stuff in New York, there's lots of stuff in New Jersey, I think there's something up in Westchester. There's a few of them around, and they're generally linked to other repeaters, so, you know, they're used as extended inputs.
So as I see it, Bob, there is activity out there, and you're one of the rare guys that's pursuing that frequency region. As you make progress in this, as you develop better antennas, better range, find out more of the repeaters and so on, please come back and check with us periodically and let us know what you find out. KD2CGL, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you for answering my questions. The three that I have actually in my HT is the Great South Bay Amateur Radio Club, 20 miles to the east. That works. And the one in Manhattan, Rockefeller Center, 20 miles to the west. And I'm constantly hearing the one in Rockland County up there, 35 miles straight up north. So thank you for answering my questions, and I will get back to you. This is KD2CGL, back to net.
Oh, the one good thing about 900 is that most people are transmitting less than a watt.
Yeah, particularly the cordless phones. I think they're in the milliwatt region. Robert, when you heard those particular signals that you just described to us, the 900 megs, what were you using for an antenna? Were you using just the rubber duck on your G29 and you were standing at a high altitude, or using some kind of an external antenna when you did it? And when you find out what antenna you'd like to buy or build and install, let us know. But what were you using when you got those particular receptions, Robert? KD2CGL, K2RIW.
Yeah, the antenna that came with this HT, as most often do, is not all that great. Fortunately, the guy I got this from, he included a Diamond SRH229, which definitely seems to be a little bit better. I'm up 20 feet in a wood frame house, and that does make a difference, no question about it. So, I was thinking about getting that M-squared antenna there, the one with the 21 decibels of forward gain. It's on a 15-foot boom. $400 is not all that bad. The good thing about 900 megs is the antennas are so small, you can actually put this in your bedroom. It's amazing.
900 works very well, by the way. And there are folks on sideband, too.
Yeah, when people go from FM repeater operation over to single sideband. Granted, the repeater gives you a lot of range because it's usually a high power output transmitter on a high location. But when it comes to person-to-person transmission, FM doesn't go very far. Single sideband will go a hell of a lot further. A good single sideband receiver for the same amount of power being transmitted, a sideband receiver has decibel, let me think now, at least 10 decibels more sensitivity. In other words, the signal can be 10 times weaker, and you still get good audio out of it with single sideband. So when you talk to the more sophisticated guys on 900 meg or 1296 that are on single sideband, you'll get some nice range. You'll be able to pick some brains of relatively smart people, and they're fun to talk to. So should you be using FM or single sideband on 900 megs? The answer is yes. Use them all if you've got the right equipment for it. And when it comes to getting commercial equipment with sideband capability on 900 megs in the United States, my guess is that kind of equipment is pretty rare. Am I right on that one, Eric? KE2EJ, KQRIW?
No, in the commercial realm of radios that we're used to looking at, yeah, they don't exist. But Down East Microwave makes some nice transmitters. There's a couple other, there's a German company that makes some great transmitters. There's quite a few of them out there. Don't forget, the 900 range stuff, like Motorola or Harris, those people. They're right next door, so we usually move the commercial stuff down into the AM area without a problem. So you'll find a lot of that stuff, but the guys that are on site, man, they pretty much either built their own stuff or they're using transmitters.
Now, when it comes to equipment for 900 megs with a pretty good capability, Bruce N2LIV out in St. James was reasonably well equipped on that band. He had in his backyard a pair of 90-foot crank-up towers with quite a few Yagis on each tower, four 900 megs, and well, among other frequencies. Bruce is now a silent key, and I'm handling his estate. And I've looked at the first list of equipment, which is the big stuff, high power supplies and Kenwood 2000s and stuff like that. So we're handling the big stuff first. When I do my next level of excavation of Bruce's basement, I know in boxes and in the file drawers he's got 900 megs, 1296, 10 gigs. He's got quite a few pieces of other equipment. All of those Yagi antennas have already been sold. The towers have not been sold. These are very beefy, 90-foot high, crank-down, tilt-over towers, ready for sale, if you know what I mean. They're standing in the backyard of Bruce's QTH, and they could be had for a very nice price. And I'm not talking about chintzy towers. Bruce went high quality. So there's some good stuff on the way along these lines as I see it. And with any further questions or comments, give me a call that is right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, I think it's time to go over to the mailbag. And John, KC2WGB, the co-host of this repeater. John, I hope these guys with you, these very fancy letters they mail you and emails, sometimes they really floor us with some very high-quality questions. Let's see what you got tonight. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Dick, first, we have a gentleman in Connecticut, Hartford, Connecticut, that's been trying to get in. N1KBY. Give a little break, or put a call out to him, see if he can make it. He's having trouble with the even hearing us. I don't know if he'll make it, but I got that message on the chat room.
Okay, Jeffrey in Smithsburg, Connecticut, N1KBY. We're going to stand by for you, Jeffrey. Go right ahead with your question or comment. N1KBY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Connecticut, John. Maybe 375 is closer to him.
Yes, I don't know which one he's trying to get in through, but all right, we'll give him a break.
I was hearing N1KBY beautifully on the input, but apparently he's giving me a strong signal. For whatever reason, the repeater is not hearing him, and the first thing I would worry about, Jeff, is that do you have a PL transmitter tone turned on, and the PL for transmission must be a 4Z, 136.5 hertz of PL. And the confusion is that this repeater has a PL in its output, which is on some other PL. frequency, and people will make the mistake of thinking that if they set that PL frequency, they're doing right. So give us a brief transmission now, Jeff. Are you using a PL of 136.5 on your transmissions? Because I'm hearing you beautifully in the input, but you're not coming through the repeater. You got it, Jeff.
Okay, very good, Dick. Got you that time. And good evening to everyone on the net. Yeah, just to recap, I was having a little trouble getting in with Echolink. It was refusing connection. So I was about to post a chat room question about Echolink, because I had never logged into it before. Just as I was typing the chat in, it finally released whatever the issue was, and I was able to make an Echolink connection. Quite so great, getting a little bit of interference. Thank goodness for Echolink, and thanks for maintaining that service. It's a big help, and I do enjoy listening to the TechNet. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, N1KBY, up in Simsbury, Connecticut.
Now we're hearing you beautifully, Jeffrey. Tiny bit of noise in the background, but you're solid copy. I think you said you do have a question, maybe about the Echolink itself. And thank goodness that John, KC2WGB, is continuously monitoring that website, so he knows when people are trying to check in. That's how we found out about you. And now we're hearing you well. Was it the PL tone not turned on before or not on the right frequency? So question number one, how come we didn't hear you before and we're hearing you now beautifully? And second of all, do you have a further question? If so, you're allowed to ask it right now. N1KBY, KQLAW, the TechNet. My name is Dick. Okay.
There we go. Dick, to answer your question, absolutely yes, I had the incorrect PL tone. I wasn't expecting to make a transmission on the repeater tonight or get called out, so I think I had neglected to set the PL tone correctly. But quick twist of the rotary knob and the correct PL makes all the difference. And probably have a bunch of questions, but none of them at the moment. I'm going to go back to listening to Echolink and catch up on some other work here on the computer while I enjoy the pearls of wisdom floating to me through the ether. Back to you, K2RIW, N1KBY.
Jeffrey, you keep saying words like that, and we'll keep sending you checks. You've got a golden opportunity here. Choose one of your many questions and ask it right now. N1KBY, K2RIW.
You put me on the spot. I really don't have anything, but if you have a couple of moments towards the end and you want to run through a little bit of return loss and versus where return loss sometimes can coincide with phase, that would be an interesting chat.
Okay, I'm going to scratch the surface a little bit and give you a few words on it right now. One of the things that's not common sense, but still extremely true about transmission lines, is that a transmission line, the good news is you put a transmitter at the bottom of the transmission line, the signal flows through it, and on a good day, 95% of it ends up at the antenna. The bad news is the transmission line is very persnickety. If it's a 50-ohm piece of cable or a 75-ohm piece of cable, that's the so-called characteristic impedance of the cable because of the way it's manufactured. Inner diameter, outer diameter, and dielectric constant of the dielectric material, the insulated material. The cable is designed for some very specific number of ohms. A 50-ohm cable wants to see at the far end a pure 50-ohm resistor, nothing else. If it's a 49-ohm or a 51-ohm resistor, a little bit of signal will reflect. If it's a 25-ohm or a 100-ohm resistor, a third of the signal will reflect, and so on. So any lack of perfect resistive termination, if there's any amount of capacitance or inductance in that load at the end of the cable, some predictable amount of signal will hit that load, reflect off of it, as if it's a brick wall, and start coming back down the cable. Can you drop? The percentage of that signal that comes back tells you in quantity how much mismatch there is at the end of the cable from a pure 50 ohm resistor. The phase angle of what comes back tells you whether or not the load is too high or low in resistance. Capacitive or inductive, the phase angle gives you all of that information. Any amount of signal coming back can be measured, and you can be measured as a forward and reverse power ratio on your Berg wattmeter, your directional wattmeter. It can be measured as voltage reflection coefficient, called S11, on a vector network analyzer, and you can display that as a voltage or decibels of the difference between forward and reflected power. So you can reflection coefficient in voltage or power or dBs. Standing wave ratio can be calculated from all of the above. So there's multiple ways of describing the magnitude of the grief and even the specificity of the grief. Is it resistive, capacitive, or inductive? So if you know the length of your transmission line, and if you've got the right kind of a thing like an antenna analyzer or a vector network analyzer in the shack, then in theory, you know exactly what the antenna is doing if you want to be a scientist or an engineer. So any amount of imperfect 50 ohm load in the end of the cable is going to give you a predictable amount of reflection. And let me drop. And lots of ham radio operators have a lot of misunderstanding of this. Lots of people in the two-way radio business have a lot of misunderstanding. A lot of good engineers with 10 years experience have a lot of misunderstanding of what standing wave ratio is. A lot of ham radio operators lose a lot of sleep over this one. They think if the antenna is not adjusted for a 1.2 standing wave ratio, they think it's going to catch on fire and all kinds of bad things are going to happen. From my point of view, the threshold of grief is around 2-1. If you're under 2-1 standing wave ratio, efficiency-wise, you've arrived. A 2-1 standing wave ratio, as bad as it sounds, means that only half a dB of potential signal loss takes place. In the worst case, only half a dB for 2-1. By the time you get up to a 5.8 standing wave ratio, yeah, half your power is reflecting, and that ain't so good. The one thing where people get a lot of grief these days that we all like to use, we like to use the so-called modern no-tune transmitter. And to remove those tuning and loading controls of the Pi network we used to have as the output of all our transmitters. What we got in return is a more compact transmitter. What we got in return is a more persnickety transmitter, where in many cases, the modern-day transmitter, an 80 through 10 meter, 100 watt rig, if it sees more than about a 1.5 or 1.6 VSWR, which is a very low number, it goes into a self-protect mode where it either stops transmitting or transmits a lower power output to protect its final stages. So those transmitters are kind of persnickety. In the case of 2 meters and 450 equipment, many of those transmitters will tolerate extremely high standing wave ratio and keep on cranking. The rubber dump antenna on your handy-talkie will tolerate a 5-1 standing wave ratio and keep right on transmitting, if you know what I mean. So it's a mixed bag as to how bad is the standing wave ratio and what does it really mean. But you now know where it comes from. In the old days, we didn't have modern-day test equipment like antenna analyzers, vector network analyzers, VSWR meters, VSWR bridges, directional power meters. We didn't have all that equipment. In the old days, it was done with a slotted line or Letcher wires. But it worked. And so you could, if you want to, let me draw a question. You could very easily construct a Letcher wire or slotted line system today and make the measurement by the old-fashioned way if you want to. And if you know what you're doing, you can get some very accurate measurements out of that. So as you can see, there's a zillion ways of measuring it, Jeff. But still, the interpretation is still the same. How much power is reflected? And one of the biggest errors that people make is they assume that because of a less than perfect balance at the antenna, and they change the length of the transmission line, and for a couple of possible sources of error, they see the standing wave ratio go up or go down when they change the length of the transmission line. They therefore jump to the conclusion that some magic length of transmission line is going to make the standing wave ratio disappear. Wrong, but they believe that. And the next step of that, and a number of two-way radio people believe this, that unless there's a magical length of transmission line, multiples of a half wave, multiples of one wave, or whatever, that the bird watt meter is not going to read correctly, and the antenna is not going to perform correctly. There's a zillion people out there who believe that old wives' tale, dead wrong. But because of the way they made the changes and the way they saw the needle move differently, and they come to these conclusions, you listen across the 20-meter band on a Saturday afternoon, you'll hear a whole bunch of guys talking about make sure your transmission line is a magic number of half wavelengths on each one of the bands in order to get full performance out of the antenna. You hear people transmitting that garbage day in and day out, and it's dead wrong. N1KBY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Jeff.
Thanks, Dick, for the nice explanation. Yeah, the misinformation certainly doesn't do the hobby any favors. Well, I'm going to send it back to you, and I'll pop in next weekend for perhaps another question or two. I do have to get back to some things here at my desk, but keep up the great work down there, and we'll keep on listening up here. 7-3 for now. KW2RIW, N1KBY.
Dick, I got a question for you.
And I'll keep mailing the checks to you, Jeff. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, that little discussion reminded me of something. I have a question for you. When you put your phase arrays together, because actually I'm having an issue with my coincide. Okay, you use a power divider. Now, in theory, let's say you've got a four-point power divider. It's basically, think of it as two T's. And a hunk of metal with four output connectors that hook to one central piece of the semiconductor coax and goes out to four 50-ohm antennas, that appear to be 50-ohm loads. Now, that's four 50-ohms in parallel. Okay, we don't think of it that way. Let's say now something's wrong with a single antenna, and you're looking at it with a VNA, what would you expect to see? K2RIW, K2J.
There's probably about five or so different ways that ham radio operators want to feed four separate Yagis, for instance, and want to feed them all in phase. And now, do they have one simple object that's got one input connector and four output connectors? There's a kind of impedance-matched 4-to-1 power divider. You can also do it with arrays of T connectors and the right lengths of cables between the T connectors. So there's various ways that you can simultaneously get a 4-to-1 power divide and good impedance match. If you really just put with very short length a series of T connectors together so that you have four antennas truly in parallel, then your transmitter would see a 12 and a half ohm impedance. And it's going to be moderately unhappy. That's a 4-to-1 standing wave ratio. Very few of us will go that way. Although, I did do that once in an antenna contest. I know that I was putting two separate groups of antennas together during this antenna gain measurement contest that took place in Saddlebrook Park in New Jersey way back in the dark ages. And I didn't have a good 2-to-1 power divider. I just used a simple T connector to put the two antennas literally in parallel with each other. And I knew darn well that that's making a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. A 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, I know that in the worst case, subtracts half a dB of power, but I'm measuring 15 and 16 dB gain antennas, a pair of them. Let me drop. And therefore, I knew I'm in the high number of dBs I'm going to get on this measurement, and I just wasted half a dB of it because of using a dumb T connector with no impedance matching. Various people came along and said, you can't do that. It's going to crash and burn. I said, oh, really? I'm going to do it anyhow. And that particular antenna was a winning antenna that particular year. I think it was around 1975. And yes, half a dB of loss took place, but I had enough extra gain to, left over, if you know what I mean. It was still the highest gain antenna in that particular group of 16 or so antennas being measured. So there are times when a simple dumb T connector, as bad as it sounds, is not the end of the world. If you understand the physics behind. Now, if I've got a good impedance matching 4-to-1 power divider, And now, here's another problem. When we amateurs build a 4-to-1 power divider, we build or buy power dividers that have no isolation built in. A commercially made 4-to-1 power divider has four outputs that are isolated from each other. In other words, if you took three of those connectors and measure the apparent impedance on them one at a time, while the fourth one is a short circuit, an open circuit, or a dummy load, an isolated power divider would show you no difference in output impedance. Yeah, the input impedance is going to change. By the laws of physics, it has to. So we amateurs tend to use kinds of power dividers that have no isolation at all, which means the individual antennas do see each other. And that gives you some peculiar effects periodically. Let me drop it.
By the way, we broadcasters don't use isolated power dividers.
You don't have to. If I'm using Yagi-like antennas where the front-to-side ratio is so high that even though the antennas are at the power divider and not isolated from each other, but in free space they are isolated from each other, that works like a charm. Your phased array of your broadcast antennas have such a good front-to-side ratio in their radiation pattern that those individual groups of antennas are not talking to each other. Therefore, the lack of isolation in your power divider doesn't matter. If there wasn't that free space isolation, if the front-to-side ratio of your antennas was a low enough number so that the antennas could see each other radio-wise, and now you're using a non-isolated power divider, now you'll find you'll get some peculiar characteristics where the length of cable from the power divider to the two individual antennas means that each antenna now has two separate ways it gets a signal. One through the cable from the power divider, one through the free space lack of isolation. And depending on the length of that cable and the separation of the antennas, those two separate methods of feeding antenna A can be in phase and out of phase, and you get some peculiar effects when you change length of cable or change spacing between the antennas. We amateurs usually don't run into that problem. Let me drop. But now when I've got a 4-to-1 power divider without isolation, I've got three good antennas and one bad antenna, which maybe is a dead short or a dead open circuit. So all the signal going into the antenna, in theory, every bit of it's being reflected. And now that reflected signal, a certain amount of it goes to the other antennas because of the lack of isolation of the power divider, and a predictable amount of that signal comes back to your input common port. There is a way of predicting the magnitude of the standing wave ratio you will see at that common input connector depending on how bad is that one antenna. So unfortunately, the amount of VSWR you get in that circumstance is relatively low, and now you've got an ambiguity. When you see a 1.1 standing wave ratio go to a 1.3, you now ask yourself, is there water in those connectors? Is that the way it was designed originally? Did one of the antennas go bad? Did all of the antennas change a little bit? You've got a lot of ambiguity. Until you start using time domain reflectometry or some other analysis technique, figuring out what happened to one antenna, all antennas, or some other common port of the system is not easy. I think you're looking for a simple test to tell you if one of the antennas failed, and it's not quite as easy as like it to be, in my opinion, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, let me tell you the little story that brought this up. It's actually something that I'm experiencing and haven't quite figured out yet. I've got a low-power TV transmitter that is actually unidirectional. It's on the Empire State Building. It looks towards a particular area of interest. It's made out of four bays of really moderate gain antenna, the panel. They're probably bow tied under the panel, but I have no idea what's underneath them. There's a phasing harness that hooks that stuff up to a four-port power divider, which is nothing more than a long tube, which is really an impedance matcher, and it goes from a smaller diameter to a slightly larger diameter. You know about that story. It hits a block of metal and then goes out four ports that are, you know, away from one another. Now, the interesting part about this, when the antennas are cold, oh, I know, by the way, first you can put a VNA on it, And the visual will come back looking at like 1.107, 110 to 1 in that neighborhood. But about 30 seconds to 60 seconds.